Hey folks, if you were trying to catch the live stream this morning, you realize that it had all sorts of technical problems. It seemed like we had broadcast issues on this end, and not really sure why exactly, but they were recurring and ongoing, and it was a bit of a debacle. So what I've decided to do is I'll just do a recording of the same content, and we'll post that. And that way, at least if people want to come to an uninterrupted experience of this, they can, and it'll be there for later. So that's what this is. This is not the live stream. As a family, we've been pretty much in voluntary quarantine since the pandemic response got more intense here in Manitoba a couple of weeks ago. Nobody in the house had any symptoms, but we did have a couple of kids with colds, and we've been able to switch many aspects of our work over to virtual, so we just thought it was best to, you know, stay home and wash our hands until they start to crack, and then slather on the moisturizer and do it again. And so we've been home. But I've been the designated hitter to go out and about as necessary to get groceries or to join the Great National Toilet Paper Hunt. I was thinking maybe we should just turn it into a treasure hunt, like officially, and just hide chocolate Easter eggs in toilet paper packages or lottery tickets or something. And just see if we can make this thing go completely bonkers, but for a reason, you know, because there's an egg in one of those or something, because it seems a little nonsensical. But anyway, I was at a larger grocery store earlier this week, and I noticed something interesting. And I noticed it first around me and then inside of me. I'll unpack that a bit. The store had done several things to remind people about keeping our distance from one another. They had put out signage, they'd taped lines on the floors, there were plexi shields for the cashiers, people were on disinfectant duty, and so on, which I really appreciate. And a moment to say thank you to the staff in these situations, the people who are out there working, and not just in these situations, obviously, in healthcare and other essential services as well, but this one I encountered, and so I want to speak to it. I feel fairly confident that not everybody that's there working is there because they feel comfortable being there. And even if they do feel comfortable being at work under the circumstances, it's still, there's these major disruptions to their workplace, and they're still waiting in there and doing these things so we can, you know, go get groceries or whatever. And I'm really grateful. Thank you. All those changes to that environment, those were things that I was more or less anticipating. Didn't feel like there were any big surprises there. What I thought was fascinating was watching all of us humans trying to make the adjustments. Now, with occasional exceptions, it seems like Shireen and I, when we have our normal Sunday morning gatherings, Shireen and I both end up at the same superstore afterward. We both tend to do a bit of a grocery run then. But with that exception notwithstanding, I don't tend to see people that I know at superstore. So I'm in this great big box filled with people that I don't know, and we're all trying to figure out what the new social rules are. And some of us are trying to send the, I get it, we're in this together, let's help one another do this thing. And we're trying to send those signals. And we can't all stop and have that conversation. So there's these little smiles and these little nods. There's kind of this acknowledgement of the new space and the new rules that we don't quite know, but we're working on it. And everyone says there's sort of this bashful, you know, I'm sorry, you go first, when we miscalculate how much space it really takes to have a human plus a great big superstore grocery cart plus 6 feet around the whole thing in this aisle that's not really designed for that, and somebody's, you know, kind of rerouting and going around the display because the aisle's too narrow on the other side, and all these kind of things. And feels generally goodwill and good nature prevail. Some folks look grumpy and afraid, right? And if you accidentally get too close, you kind of get this fierce back off glare. But overall, there's just a fair bit of looking and feeling off balance. And actually off balance. Not just as a metaphor for something. Once I noticed this stuff, I started to pay attention to what my own body was feeling and doing. And I realized that I was just sort of jerky. Like, I typically race around the grocery store. I got my list in one hand, I got my pen in the other, and the cart kind of in between. And I'm just, I don't hate grocery shopping, but I'm not doing it for fun. I'm doing it to get it done and get on with the day. And I'm just, that's what I'm doing. I'm just getting it done. And now that just didn't work. I was constantly having to reconsider and recalibrate and change course. I thought about it later, and it seems to me that when someone asks how I'm doing these days, my stock answer could honestly be, I'm adjusting. constantly, ceaselessly, endlessly adjusting. No wonder we feel exhausted at the end of the day. It's like walking on ice, but somebody's constantly tilting the angle of the slabs without warning. When I was a kid, my parents opened their own contracting business in this small northern town where we lived. My dad had sort of been working out of the back of his truck for a while, and he built a new shop and a small office on the back, and he and my mom really kind of hung out their public shingle, and they had this grand opening event. Pretty entrepreneurial thing to do in a little town, it seems to me, looking back on it now. Dad and mom were full partners in this venture, and between the two of them, the shop was all cleaned up, and they had these pithy quotes that they'd lettered and framed and hung up in various parts of the shop. And you have to remember that this was pre-internet, which is sort of like prehistory, right? Like, did anything actually exist before we started to write it down? Did anything actually exist before the internet? And so you couldn't just like go on Google and type in, you know, top 20 pithy quotes for opening a northern Canadian construction company and get this great list or something. And so I don't really know where they got these things. A public library, a book of quotes they had for, you know, casual reading somewhere in the house. I'm not sure. But they had these quotes written down and posted all around the shop. And I don't remember most of them, but there are two that have stuck in my head over the decades. Both feel like they have something to say to the present circumstances and to this feeling of being off balance. So I looked these up on the internet so I could feel confident about their attribution. The first was, new times demand new measures. That is consistently credited to James Russell Lowell, who was an 1800s American romantic poet, critic, editor, diplomat. The fuller quote from which that's taken has kind of a weight of wisdom to it that I hope can help us see past its relentless commitment to man being equal to person. So it's very patriarchal language, very gendered language for humanity in this. But I think the wisdom transcends or can rise above that. So here's the whole quote. New times demand new measures and new ways. The world advances and in time outgrows the laws that in our fathers' day were best. And doubtless, after us, some better scheme will be shaped by wiser men than we, made wiser by the steady growth of truth. That's a fairly optimistic view of change, and not a big surprise given its point in time and history, and even its geographic location. I appreciate that it doesn't stop at the present age, but it looks to the future. And I also appreciate that its emphasis is on things like wisdom and truth rather than on laws. I mean, the laws are there in the quote, right? The laws that were in our father's day were best, but it goes on from there to wisdom and truth. And the reason I think that's important is because laws are things we make and have. They're things about which we might feel relatively certain, even though we have people to interpret them and we find that necessary. But if laws are things we make and have, wisdom and truth are things we seek. They're things we just keep pursuing. They're not endpoints. They're open. And that feels to me like it helps make room for the ancient voices to still speak rather than just the voices of contemporary trends or values. New times demand new measures. And sometimes those measures are actually very old ones that feel new because they've been out of view for a while. The second quote, which outlasted the grand opening of my parents' shop and remained hanging behind my dad's working desk, which was just a big table so he could spread out blueprints and things. It stayed behind that desk as long as that business existed. That quote said this, "What shall it profit a man if he shall gain the whole world but lose his soul?" Now, that one is consistently attributed to Jesus. It's found in the Gospel of Mark. The New Living Translation rescues it from its patriarchal language and says it this way. "And what do you benefit if you gain the whole world but lose your soul? Is anything worth more than your soul?" Now, for my dad, that wasn't some kind of theological abstraction to muse about. It was a compelling personal question that I watched him work out as a father and a husband and a business owner every day. And only now do I feel like I'm beginning to appreciate how complex that must have sometimes been. The linkage between new times demanding new measures and this powerful and ongoing question of how we might proceed in times of change without jeopardizing our essence as human beings, what the passage from Mark calls our soul, that feels like a pretty current question. Tim, how are you doing? Well, I'm adjusting. And what's helping you keep your balance? What's helping you not violate your center, your soul, in the midst of all that slipping and sliding, all of that adjusting? Well, that might take a little bit more exploring. This past week, someone sent me a link to a perspective on all of this that resonated really deeply for me. I think this article that this is from has picked up a bit of momentum online in the past few days, so you might have seen the article. It was published in the Harvard Business Review under the title, "That Discomfort You're Feeling is Grief." So if you want to see the whole thing, that's where you can find it. Most of that article was an interview with David Kessler. Kessler is the co-author, together with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, of a book that changed my understanding of this important human experience of loss. The book is called On Grief and Grieving, Finding the Meaning of Grief Through the Five Stages of Loss. And that idea that grief can be considered through the lens of stages of loss has become a fairly common one by now. But when it was first published in 2005, it was a fairly groundbreaking, important piece of work. Kessler, Kubler-Ross has since passed away. Kessler continues that work and has added a sixth book, Finding Meaning, sixth stage of loss. Can't remember the precise title, and I don't have it in my notes, but he has added a sixth stage to that. But Kessler is an American expert on loss and healing, and his own story is an interesting one in that regard. It includes childhood trauma. It includes the sudden loss of his 21-year-old son as an adult, and he works with people in all kinds of situations of loss and suffering. He knows some things about grief. And in the article, the interviewer's lead question was this. They asked, "People are feeling any number of things right now. Is it right to call some of what they're feeling grief?" And Kessler responded this way. He said, "Yes, and we're feeling a number of different griefs. We feel the world has changed, and it has. We know this is temporary, but it doesn't feel that way, and we realize things will be different." By which he means things will be different after these events. And he illustrates that by talking about what it's like to go to the airport post 9/11. We go back to the airport, we continue to fly and so on, but going to the airport is not the same experience it was before those events. It's changed forever. So that's what he's gesturing toward. And then he goes on to mention loss of normalcy, fear of economic toll, loss of connection, cites these as examples of losses that we're grieving. When I read the interview, Kessler sort of had me from hello with these ideas, and I think partly I was positively predisposed because Kubler-Ross's book had been a really informative and helpful experience for me way back when. But even while I knew that Kessler was doing something that most popular authors and speakers are really good at, which was putting ordinary words around big personal ideas or experiences, at the same time that I was realizing that's what he's doing, I was having this other experience that was like he was giving me really useful handles for my own sense of being off balance and skittering along on this icy surface of constant and widespread change. If you've read the article, this will be a little bit of a recap, but I want to at least summarize his overview of how the stages of grief might help us frame what we're feeling these days. This is not some kind of last word on all of this, but I hope it might be helpful. And as always, as part of the ethos of the table, if this is helpful, pick it up. And if it's not, just, you know, lay it down. Don't take it on. If you're familiar with the model, you'll recognize these stages as being in order from 1 to 5. Just a reminder that grief and loss are not linear experiences. They don't tidally unfold 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, but sometimes these things can provide us with a framework that's helpful for where we're at. And we often have to circle back into these processes. So if you've ever been close to someone that's in a 12-step program or been in a program like that yourself, or other kind of step recovery programs, you'll know that when you have the experiences you're having in recovery, sometimes you end up circling back to an earlier stage. You're deep in stage eight somewhere, and all of a sudden you're like, oh my goodness, I really need to go back and, you know, make some amends. I need to back up into an earlier step and repeat it. And that can happen over and over again in the process. Anyway, I will go through them in order. Stage one in these five stages is denial. So if we look at the experience we might be having with this pandemic through that lens, this would be the stage where we might be saying something early on like, wow, you know, too bad about all those elderly, heavy smoking Italian men that are so vulnerable to the symptoms of this disease, but that's not me, and I'm not there, and so this is going to be fine. Or we might just keep kicking that can down the road, and we can really kick denial down the road ahead of us for a long ways. We might be sort of like, move it to Canada, right? Well, you know, too bad about all those six folks in BC. Must be really hard to live in a province where there's all this international travel coming in all the time, and in the early stages, you know, maybe coming in from eastern part of the world where this disease has its origins, and man, but that's not me, that's not us, and so it's going to be fine. Stage two is anger, and this is the stage where we feel like we're being done to. This is the Justin, you bearded. Anyway, you know, you're doing this to me. You're making me stay home, and you're taking away all the things I like to do. I can't go to the gym. I can't go to my classes. I can't go to... You're taking away my work. You're taking away my livelihood. You're making it hard for me to provide for my family, for me to live my life. You're doing this to me, and I'm angry. In stage two, the anger stage, our experience of loss is somebody else's fault. Stage three is bargaining. Okay, I'll keep the rules. I'm going to stay home for 2 weeks, but then we can get back to normal life, right? Or even, you know, you might still have to be in quarantine because you were just in the States. But I already kept that 2 week rule, and so now I get to go out, right? I get to return to my normal life. Yeah? And we don't just bargain with others. We bargain and rationalize with ourselves. And if I start illustrating that, we'll be here all day because we're very creative about rationalizing our own preferences. But that's what happens in stage three, is we bargain. Stage four is sadness. I don't know when this will end. And that makes me sad. I feel sad. Stage five is acceptance. Okay, this is really happening. This is actually happening. This is happening to me. This is happening to us. This is happening to my family, to people that I know, people that I care about, people that are proximate to me. Now I have to figure out how to proceed. And it's that last stage, acceptance, that's where we can get some sense of life being a little bit less out of control. We can start to imagine what we can do, and we can even start to do it. I can wash my hands. I can cough into my sleeve. I can stay home. I can give people room when I need to go out. I can become a Zoom wizard. I can figure out why the live stream doesn't work and see if I can fix that. We can learn how to focus on what is within our control rather than what isn't, and to do what we can. We can also learn how to let go of our indefensible belief that we're only in a good world when we are in control. Now, it might seem initially like those two ideas are in conflict with one another. You know, focus on what you can control and learn that you are not in control. But we can see that they are not in conflict when we understand that it's a question of how we think about our human place in the world. We've got a lot of agency as humans. There's a lot we can do. And we know this because, even just because of this pandemic experience, we know that if we can collectively behave as well as possible, as best we understand what's good and helpful behavior around this, we can flatten the curve. We can change the way the virus is transmitted into how many people in ways that allow our healthcare systems to respond and bear the load without being overwhelmed. We can influence the course of a global event by pulling together. And we already know this from the things that we've been wrestling with regarding climate change. We know this from watching the satellite photographs of what happens to pollution when we stop driving because we're forced to for a pandemic, and all of a sudden the skies within weeks are clear, much clearer. And when we start to drive again, it comes right back. So we can see that we have a lot of agency. We can make a difference. And that's really important, because when we focus on what we can do and we do those things, our stress levels tend to be reduced, our anxiety levels tend to be reduced. We do better as human beings in the midst of the experience, and that's super important. What we don't have is complete agency. We don't control everything. Now, this is the terrain that we tend to wind up in when we're exploring big human questions. How will we think about, slash understand, slash live well with the fact that there is clearly more to this life than we can fully comprehend or apprehend, and that as big a deal as we humans are, we are not ultimate. We are not the last word. And of course, how we respond to that kind of realization varies widely. There's more than one way to respond to that, obviously, right? When we focus on doing what we can, we're not trying to deny the tension between those two things. In fact, we're pretty much trying to do the opposite. When we focus on doing what we can and we begin there, what we're trying to do is get ourselves to stop spinning long enough to consider how these truths in tension can inform a hopeful, heartening view of the world and a healthy way to live in it, even when, maybe especially when, things are not going the way we planned or the way that we think they should. If we start to poke around in the wisdom of the ancients on this, we realize pretty quickly that although COVID-19 might be a unique human experience and a global pandemic with this sort of rapid movement is a unique human experience, that feeling like the world is out of control and not going the way we want it to is not a unique human experience. We have been here before. We have been here before collectively. We've been here before as people groups, as tribes, as nations, as a species. And we have reflected on what this tension between there are things I can do and need to do and I'm not in control of everything. We've reflected on what that tension might mean and how to wrestle with it, how to continue to seek things like wisdom and truth in the midst of those experiences. One of the things that came to mind when I started to think about ancient wisdom on this, of course, because of the traditions I've grown up in, was from Hebrew sacred text, and in particular from the book of Ecclesiastes, which, you know, rumbles around in this terrain its entirety. And so just one section from that to close this reflection. Ecclesiastes 3. And Ecclesiastes seems to be a collection of human wisdom. It's not like some one person sat down and just like wrote the whole thing out. And so I think about this when I read it as a kind of a compendium, a bit of a gathering together of human wisdom on this tension between things we understand and can do and things we don't understand but continue to wrestle with. So I'll just read you a little bit from Ecclesiastes 3. For everything, there is a season, a time for every activity under heaven. That's sort of the New Times Demand New Measures part. That's the bit that, you know, lots of us know. But it goes on from there. A time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to harvest, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to tear down and a time to build up, a time to cry and a time to laugh, a time to grieve and a time to dance, a time to scatter stones and a time to gather stones, a time to embrace and a time to turn away, a time to search and a time to quit searching, a time to keep and a time to throw away, a time to tear and a time to mend, a time to be quiet and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. I want to encourage us as a community to not shy away from the conundrums, even when they challenge us deeply. Let's focus on what we can do. We need to do that. That's important. It will help. And we need to continue to explore what we believe, even when it's not clear where that exploration will take us, or even if we feel like it's clear that that exploration will not take us to a new certain endpoint, but rather to more exploration and more contemplation and more reflection. New times demand new measures, and one of the reasons for that is that wisdom keeps unfolding. It keeps drawing us into the questions, and it's in that process, in that journey into the questions, that we're formed as people, and that's important. That equips us to live in a world where we have agency, but not ultimate agency. So, let's do the things that we can, and let's use the time that we have to explore the meaning of those we can't. Thank you for listening. Thanks for wading through the technical challenges to be together as a community. We'll keep on with that for as long as we need to and as long as we can. All right? Peace, everybody. Bye for now.